The 1995 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 273, a reading, Hot Off the Press, by Michael Philorup.
We should probably get started. Welcome to this session of Sunstone. They tell us it's being recorded and they want us to begin. The format today will be an introduction of Michael Philorup by Lisa Orm Bickmore, who is also a writer, poet primarily, and essayist. And there will be food and drink over to the side, and feel free during the reading to partake. And we'll actually have a little more of that coming out in about 45 minutes, and hopefully we'll be joined by some other people from some other sessions about then. After the reading, after questions and answers, we'll also have books for sale up here if anybody is interested. So, Lisa?
I'm honored and pleased to be able to introduce Michael Philorup to you. Most of you will be familiar with at least some of his work, but I'd like to tell you a little bit about his work and then turn the time over to him to read from his newest. Michael is a bilingual and ESL director in Flagstaff, Arizona. He has published fiction many places and won many awards for his fiction, including contests in Sunstone and Dialogue, and also an award from the Association for Mormon Letters. He has published a book of short stories called Visions and Other Stories, and many, as I said, many short stories in magazines. His newest work is entitled Beyond the River, and there are lots of copies here available for inscription and sale. He has, on a more personal note, been married for 20 years to Rebecca, and has four children ranging in ages from 19 to 11. And Michael, we'll be glad to hear from you.
Repeat questions into microphone. Okay. Thank you, Lisa. It is really a pleasure to be here today. I'm honored that all of you would take time out of your busy lives and schedules to come and listen to me read from my book. Before I get started, I need to publicly thank a few people who were instrumental in bringing this book to its present state. A little background. I sent my original manuscript for this book to Signature Books in 1991, and they gave me what I would call a polite rejection, and which is to say, they said, well, we're interested, but it's not quite there yet. And then they suggested that I contact Levina Fielding Anderson for specific suggestions on how I might improve the book. Well, I had corresponded with Levina over the years, but I still haven't met her face-to-face. And I have, and I'd never spoken to her. So I called her on the phone, and she answered and found, and when she heard it was me, it was like meeting my fairy godmother. It was like I was talking to my guardian angel. She just extolled my virtues as a human being for 20 minutes. And then she talked about what a great writer I was. And I was getting all puffed up. And I was beginning to think, those guys at Signature Books don't know what they're talking about. This is a great book. I mean, it was 600 pages long. It looked like a recycled version of War and Peace, and it read like the New York Stock Exchange. Well, anyway, then Levina said, she said the one thing, the fatal line that all honest writers, if they're honest with themselves, that they hate to hear, I do have a few suggestions. And I said, well, great. I'll go get a pencil and a sheet of paper. And she said, get the whole tablet. So 32 pages later, as I was scooping up my ego from the floor, I decided, well, okay, we'll give this another whirl. So I went to work and did a major overhaul and resubmitted the manuscript to Signature Books. And the second time around, they accepted it. I did another revision on it. And then it was turned into the capable hands of Ron Pritis. By this time, I had cut it down to 350 pages. And Ron, over here, had the task of going through and editing my work, the book. And he cut it down to a lean and mean 250 pages and just did a wonderful job. He really did. I was really impressed with the work he did. So I want to publicly thank Ron and Levina, and there's someone else I want to publicly thank. Oh, the other person I need to publicly thank is my wife Rebecca, who is right here. I don't know if for anyone who is married to a writer or whose writer is their significant other, they can empathize with Rebecca's plight. It's no picnic living with someone, sharing your life with someone who at least 50% of the time is in an altered state, and they kind of exist in this no man's land. They're not here, there, or anywhere, but in this kind of mythical, magical kingdom they've developed in their minds. And most of the time, it looks more like the spirit prison than paradise. You've got all kinds of weird characters running out of there. So I need to publicly acknowledge the supports that she's given me over the last 20 years. And we both live to tell about it. When I got my program, I got a preliminary program back in January. And I started flipping through the pages to see where they had inconspicuously tucked my name inside among the other, the giants of the Sunstone Symposiums, like Levi Peterson and Sterling McMurrin and Susan Howe and, you know, all these other big name people, Linda Sillitoe. And then I opened to page 27, and there is this huge picture, one quarter of the page. And there I am in living black and white. And it's got my name in bold print. And I have to confess, I'm glad that Signature Books is providing food for this thing, to back all that billing. The book, Beyond the River, in the program, it describes it as, it says it is the odyssey of a liberal, middle-aged Mormon man. And when I read that, I kind of chuckled to myself, because I have people who come up to me, friends, say, well, what's your book about? And I always say, in one good English sentence, you know, I don't know what the book about. I just wrote the thing. And I'm not like those gifted people who, you know, the people who can, who have that capability, that reductionist gift, where they, and they write the one sentence summaries for the movie listings, you know, in the weekly TV listings, and they'll say, Ben-Hur, A Tale of Christ, childhood friends reunite in a chariot race. You know, that tells the whole thing, the whole 4-hour epic. I can't do that. So as I reread what they said, the little description there, the book is definitely an odyssey because it covers different periods of this, of the main character's life, John Reeves, beginning when he's a teenager, and then it talks about him as a young adult, and then, of course, middle age. Liberal, well, I'm always uncomfortable with categories and labels, but I guess he's more liberal than not. And he is definitely middle-aged. And when people say, oh, it's a midlife crisis story, then I kind of cringe at that, because when I think of midlife crisis, I think of these middle-aged guys running around with getting hair transplants and buying red Corvettes and dumping their wives and chasing after 19-year-old Valley girls. And it's not really that. So I like to call it a midlife examination. I think Ron wrote what I consider to be a really excellent summary of the story that I'd just like to share with you. He says that Beyond the River paints a portrait of modern life in three stages, like a triptych tracing teenage, young adult, and midlife changes in a Californian named John Reeves. Inspired by manic highs, defiance of authority, and religious cynicism, Reeves' joie de vivre dissipates when confronted by unexpected tragedy. His response is to enlist as a Mormon missionary in Mexico. Reeves later sees the cycle of his moods and beliefs repeated in his children. His sense of inadequacy, of broken dreams, drives him to desperate acts of inner reconciliation. This book is destined to be a classic and a cinch to win the National Book Award. Oh, no, that's not in there. Anyway. Well, with that, I had another thing. When I saw that picture in the Sunstone program, that big black and white picture, I faced a moral dilemma. I had to decide, do I wear the hat or do I not wear the hat? And so after a great amount of deliberation, I thought, well, they'll recognize me if I wear the hat. But on the other hand, you know, my wife tells me she'd never wear a hat indoors. So, like William Shakespeare said, what he hath scanted men in hair, he hath given them in wit. So, all right. I'm like one of those middle-aged guys, you know, that needs to get a hair transplant. All right. Let me tell you give you a little bit of background information on Beyond the River. As I mentioned, it's the story of, it's really the story of two people. Main character is John Reeves. And the story begins where in John Reeves is a senior in high school. He's a super jock. He's stuck up, blonde, you know, tall, blonde, all this, all the, he looks like a typical Californian. They're such a monster. And he is the only child of a well-to-do doctor in a small Northern California town. So he's a big fish in a little pond. And he's fourth generation LDS. And he's very smug in his beliefs. He's not a real devout LDS person, but he's never questioned his beliefs. He's always accepted them. And from day one, his life has been plotted out for him. He's going to, the three M's, mission, marriage in the temple, of course, and then medical school. And that's the book point picks up at that point, and then John meets a young woman. Great men and mighty nations have fallen for the sake of a beautiful woman. Troy had Helen, David Bathsheba, Samson his Delilah, Antony Cleopatra. In my mind, this was understandable, if not wholly redeemable. A pretty face, I reasoned, pays dividends in passion and prestige. What I couldn't understand was how someone like Nancy von Kleinschmidt did me under. I felt like Robert Cohn in The Sun Also Rises. Poor Cohn, the minute he falls in love, his tennis game goes to pot. I didn't fall in love with Nancy, but after meeting her, I couldn't catch a pass or win a race. My once graceful body ignored my simplest commands. I said, leap, and instead my legs crossed themselves and sent me sprawling on the grass. I said, relax, wait, concentrate, but my hands slapped crudely at the spiraling pigskin. Had I been bewitched by envious classmates? Had I contracted some rare disease? One thing was certain. It wasn't Nancy's beauty that blurred my concentration or turned my legs to sponge cake when I crouched down in the starting blocks. Frankly, Nancy wasn't much to look at. Keith called her the albino Watusi. Except for her hair, the metaphor was perfect. Tall and gangly, she was all arms, legs, and Adam's apple, a skeleton in Salvation Army hand-me-downs 2 decades out of style. Plain white blouses and dark wool skirts, thick as kilts, that reached below her knobby knees. White gym socks sagged around her ankles and giant saddle shoes bound size 13 feet. While her female classmates sheathed their nubile legs in pantyhose or fishnet stockings, she left hers bare, shapeless, sexless, a little girl's. She was aloof. If Ponderosa High had a popularity contest, she wouldn't have garnered a single vote. Yet everyone knew Nancy von Kleinschmidt. You couldn't miss her. The cultish clatter of her Oxfords as she marched down the hall with books pressed to her chest, her bushy head bobbing above the crowd. But she was a mystery. When she moved into our little pine tree town shortly after the Christmas holidays, rumors spread. She looked like a refugee. Maybe her father was a Nazi war criminal. The name fit, didn't it? Keith's explanation was more astute. She's a freak, he proclaimed on more than one occasion. In a way, he had a point. Her feathered mop combined blonde tones and textures in such a bizarre way that, with a little imagination, abstracting the bush from her head to her pointy hips, she could have passed for a Picasso rendition of an ostrich. I met her in mid-March of my senior year. I had just been notified that if I did not raise my grade in calculus from an F to a D, I would be ineligible for the league track finals in May. This is not to say I was your typical dumb jock. Now, true, I was numbered among the student athletes and was even considered something of a prodigy, especially after plucking a Hail Mary pass out of the hands of 4 defenders to give Ponderosa High School its first league title in 22 years. As a result, I got a fat head. My teammate said Rydell didn't stock a helmet big enough for John Reeves. But dumb? My cumulative grade point average was 3.6, including senior composition and chemistry. But calculus was another matter. I simply couldn't listen to Mr. Gilbert, the ex-stormtrooper, ramble on about parachutes and parabolas for an hour every afternoon, not with the obliging spring weather and the river only a few miles away. Plus, I was lazy. What didn't come naturally took a back seat in my life. So that afternoon, when I checked into the student tutoring center, I was desperate. Coach Ramirez had banned me from the track until I brought my grades up. No meets, no practices, nada. I had unwittingly secured for myself an indefinite string of free afternoons, giving further credence to the Sunday school axiom, God works in mysterious ways. I was the lone client, a relief in some ways, humiliating in others. Mrs. Larson, the grandmotherly program sponsor, directed me to a tall, gawky girl with her face buried in a book. Grinning like a lucky matchmaker, she leaned my way and whispered, as if we two were privy to some intimate secret, "That's Nancy von Kleinschmidt. She's a straight-A student. I'm sure she'll be able to help you." The introduction was unnecessary. I recognized her immediately. The tugboat shoes, the dhow-like legs. Who but Nancy von K? Though my instinct screamed, "Run!" I had no choice. It was fourth and goal, D-Day, do or die. Also, I felt sorry for her, sitting at that big deserted table like a traveler lost in time. I took a seat and waited patiently for her to explain limits and derivatives, continuity, composite functions, the precarious alchemy of numbers. At first, she continued reading, oblivious to my presence. Her book was as fat as Webster's Unabridged. I noted the title, Finnegan's Wake. 5 minutes passed. "Excuse me," I said. The book dropped, her back stiffened. Snatching the returned test paper from my hand, 52 was the score, she cracked open my calculus text and, without introducing herself or asking my name, zeroed in on the topic for the day, curve sketching techniques. "Okay," she ordered, "take out a sheet of paper and draw a grid." Before I could open my loose leaf binder, she was drilling me like a Marine Corps sergeant. "How do you find the relative extrema of the absolute value of 4 minus x squared? What's the second derivative of a function? How do you use this to find concavity? What are the inflection points? Are these oblique or horizontal asymptotes?" As I labored over problem one, she barked more orders. "Come on, faster, faster!" Yanking the paper out from under my pencil, she scribbled out the answers and thrust it back at me. "There, now try the next one. Quick, pronto, fast!" I made a feeble attempt at problem number two. "Too slow!" Her bony fist hammered the table, just like yesterday in the mile relay. Surprised, I stopped my work. "You mean, how could you let that blunderbutt from Las Plumas catch you from behind and on the anchor leg?" "That blunderbutt," I said, squaring my shoulders, "just happens to be Harold Williams, alias Harry the Horse, who holds the Mid-Valley League record for the quarter mile. I don't care if he holds Tricky Dick Nixon by the G-string. He caught you from behind." "Well, yesterday wasn't one of my better performances." "Better performances? I've seen old Coots in the convalescent home put on a better show than that. Reeves, you ran like you had 6 corn cobs up your butt." She enumerated each corn cob with a bony finger. I was stunned to silence. Other girls teased me about fumbles and mishaps on the field, but other girls had shapely thighs and pepsodent smiles. Where did this Nancy von nobody get off criticizing me? Still in shock, my only counter was a meek, "How do you figure 6? "Look at the films, you'll see." She slammed the textbook shut and, glaring at me with incriminating blue eyes, asked, "No, accused. Tell me, do you enjoy putting on a helmet and tromping around beating the mucus out of your fellow human beings every Friday night? I mean, is this your idea of personal achievement?" I hemmed and hawed while she pontificated on the morality of contact sports and the immorality of me playing them. And for some bizarre reason, I was sufficiently intrigued to stick around for a full 55 minutes of verbal abuse. There are points in time when you make split-second decisions that have lifelong consequences. I would make at least 4 such decisions in Nancy's company, but this first one started the ball rolling, so to speak, because otherwise I would have walked out of that room and never returned, leaving my fate in calculus to my own devices and Nancy von Kleinschmidt to hers. Instead, I turned to her and said, "Let's get something to eat." She shrugged and sighed condescendingly. "Oh, all right." Seconds later, the bell rang and Nancy leaped to her feet. With one swoop, she gathered up her books and mine, grabbed my wrist with her free hand, and dragged me out the door. "Whoa," I cried, "where's the fire?" She gave my arm another tug. "Kick in the gear, Reeves, or we won't beat the stampede." I looked down the hall at the mass of sweaty, urgent bodies rushing to lockers, buses, choir practice, the baseball field. The stampede had never bothered me before, but Nancy made it seem as if the entire student body were a converging mob. "Reeves," she shouted, giving my arm another yank. I shadowed her lanky body across the grassy quad to the parking lot, where she paused, hands on narrow hips, breathing deeply, the grin of victory on her face as she watched the student exodus moseying along like a human traffic jam. Standing beside her, I realized how tall she truly was. I stood a shade under 6'4", but tilted my eyes upward to meet hers. "Okay," she said, glancing around, "so where's your jalopy?" "My jalopy?" I laughed. "Over there," I said, pointing to the giant ruby shining in the far corner of the parking lot. Nancy shrugged. "A Ford, eh?" "No, a Corvette Stingray." "Ford, Corvette, what's the diff?" Was she trying to rattle my cage again, or was she simply naive? I couldn't tell. She was wearing an indifferent smirk that annoyed me, but I think I was beginning to like her. She was so unlike the drooling beauties who stroked the red enamel of my car as if it were a pet. 5 feet short of the car, she stopped and eyed my prize skeptically. You know what Ralph Nader says about Corvettes? Sorry, I'm not hep on my consumer reports. She shook her head. Death traps, real death traps. More power to Ralph, I said. Get in. Well, Nancy and John, they go to various places this afternoon. They go out and have a sandwich. And they end up going to, John takes her to a place that is very special to him. It's called the river. And it's at the bottom of a canyon. And, Ron, can you get me a glass of water? It's at the bottom of a canyon where he lives. And it's this is the place where John goes to get away from things, to escape. And he takes her down here, and they have an interesting experience down there. At the bottom, we were greeted by the sound of distant thunder. We followed the noise down a narrow foot trail of, flanked by waist-high ferns to the edge of a granite cliff. A jungle of trees and plants, many of them exotic, crowded the opposite bank. Directly below us, the waters lay still and smooth, black satin. A sweet and sour odor rose from the sandy shore. Several hundred feet downstream, a steel trestle spanned the river. In the twilight, it looked like a great metal cage with a dull polish. Just upstream, the cliffs curved inward, forming a giant horseshoe. Top dead center, the river squeezed to a narrow gap and plunged 20 feet straight down. Thank you. Okay. Where did I see? Top dead center, the river squeezed through a narrow gap and plunged 20 feet straight down, crashing between a pair of boulders that angled inward like twin whales surfacing to kiss. This was the rock. If you had hair on your chest or rocks in your head or both, you could squeeze safely between those two protruding boulders. If you leaped and lived, you were entitled to carve your initials into the trunk of a half-gone ponderosa pine rotting at the base, officially certifying your manhood or your stupidity. Before long, a squadron of bats began zigzagging above the river. Intermittently, one would dive kamikaze-style at the water, pulling out an instant before crash landing, its leather wings fluttering frenetically as it rejoined the group. "Do you think they ever misjudge?" Nancy asked. "And hit the water? I don't know. Maybe once in a while. They're hunting for insects." "I know. Are you afraid? Most girls think bats will get caught in their hair." She didn't answer. She stood there staring at the bats, not answering. "If they misjudge, it's not often," I said. "They've got radar, you know, so it's pretty hard for them to misjudge." Nancy crossed her arms and watched as if she were anticipating an aerial miscue. Then she smiled. "They never miss," she exclaimed. "Never." I looked around anxiously. Directly overhead, stars were freckling the sky. The sickle moon was a big white smile, grinning at me, no doubt. I gazed up at the towering canyon walls, which appeared to be closing like immense jaws that would soon swallow moon, stars, everything. "You're Mormon, aren't you?" "Yes." She already knew that. BYU, football scholarship. "What are you?" She laughed. "I'm Nancy. Nancy von Kleinsmid." "I know that, but what are you?" She smiled smugly. "Tell me about God." "God?" I was cautious. "Sure, what does God look like?" "Well, he looks like a man," I said. "Oh, does he? Then tell me, Reeves, what kind of a man? Does he have a mustache? Is he a red man? Black, white, yellow? Or does he change colors to fit the occasion?" "Well, he's got a body. We're created in his image. Two arms, two legs, two eyes, one nose." I was dreading her next question. "Tell me, Reeves, I'm a woman. If we're all created in his image..." "We better get going," I said. Either she didn't hear me or didn't want to. She gazed downstream, smiling in her annoyingly omnipotent way. At least she was calling off the dogs on religion, for the time being, anyway. "Why do they call it the river?" she asked. "I mean, doesn't it have a real name, like Mulligan's River or Red River or some nifty Indian name like the Wattamahoggee River?" "I don't know. Why do you ask?" "Just curious." "Maybe," but her voice had that mocking edge again. I got defensive. "First my running style, then my car, then my diet, then my religion, and now this. The river wasn't exactly a secret, but it had always been special.
Ever since my night summer when my Uncle Steve hiked me down the switchbacks to catch my first rainbow trout, it had been my refuge, a little piece of paradise in the pines. Water nymphs might have bathed here, or those Polynesian beauties you see in paintings by Gauguin. I'd brought Nancy here because I thought she would appreciate it. Had I thrown my pearls to the swine? Well, why should it have a name? I said, still smarting from our theological repartee. The river, as if there were no others. Don't you find that a little pretentious? No. She looked upriver where the shawl of falling water glistened in the skimpy moonlight. And that's the infamous rock. The rock, yes. Have you ever jumped? Sure, lots of people have. Everyone's jumped. Oh, excuse me, oh great and mighty one. She scrutinized the rock with her all-knowing smirk. Has anyone ever dived and lived to tell about it? Only two I know of, and one of them's in a wheelchair. Have you? A sudden breeze swept through the canyon, chasing off the fallen leaves and ruffling the river's surface like the fur of a frightened animal. No, I said. Will you? Dive? Please. Now, what kind of question is that, knowing what happened to Steve Valkenburg? Oh, a straightforward one, I think. Okay, and here's a straightforward answer. N-O, no. Why not? Don't be stupid. Another breeze came up, this one a bit stiffer, shaking the surrounding oaks and elms. Their porous silhouettes wiggled like schools of black fish. It was an eerie, oriental image. Will you jump, she asked. I already have. I mean today, now, she smiled. For me. Are you some kind of screwball? No, I'm Nancy, she whispered. Nancy von Kleinschmidt. You've done it before. I've got my good clothes on, I said, motioning to my polo shirt and corduroy pants. So, take them off. Oh, very funny. Mormon boys don't do that. There was something about her smile, that smirk, that challenge. Okay, Ms. Big Shot, I said, why don't you jump? I can't swim. Now it was my turn to smirk. Let's go, I said. I started back to the Corvette, smiling victoriously as I listened to her footsteps trailing behind. Suddenly they stopped. Listen, she said. It took a moment, but soon I could hear the sound of another waterfall, like an echo of the first. But instead of staying constant, it was growing louder, closer. Nancy's eyes widened. Come on, she said, and grabbed my wrist with the same urgency as she had shown in the high school parking lot, evading the mob. Now, I was a good runner, a dash man, but I had trouble keeping up. Her ostrich mop was shaking like a pom-pom as her Oxfords pounded the dirt. They say, she panted, they say there's a good foot of clearance, maybe two. What? What? She stopped at the mouth of the trestle. It protruded out of the tunnel like a piece of complex dental work. It's like a skeleton, she said, the skeleton of the tunnel. To me, it looked like a giant booby trap. Nancy, I said, but she was already striding along the ladder of railroad ties, skipping every other one. Come on, she hollered, and I did. Midway, she stopped and lay down lengthwise on the tracks. What are you doing, I said. Are you nuts? The noise grew louder, closer. Somewhere upstream, a dam had burst and the angry waters were rushing down to bury us. Hurry, John! She patted the pail impatiently. Get up, I yelled. It's not funny. Come on, John! The mouth of the tunnel filled with light. The steel cage trembled. Jonathan! She screamed. You're going to miss it! Such urgency. I could see the veins gripping her throat like a skinny, strangling hand. John! I laid my body back flat on the tracks, my head at her feet. This is crazy, I screamed. Shh! Were those my bones rattling or the wooden ties underneath me? I closed my eyes and said a quick and desperate prayer. Then, a foot? Are you sure? She laughed. Just keep your head down. She yelled something else, but her voice was smothered by the thunder. Then I did something even more stupid than lying on the tracks. I raised my head and looked back. The Cyclops' eye was hurtling towards us, splashing yellow light all over the steel cage. Panicking, I rolled over the rail, off the track. Eyes clenched, I hugged the metal bar, riding the earthquake tremors as the hissing, pounding monster roared past. I began counting to myself and didn't stop until the very last echoes had faded and nothing remained but the perfect silence you might expect after a bomb has fallen and the smoke has cleared. I opened my eyes and sat up, but suddenly I felt very cold. My hands were shaking. Nancy? She was lying perfectly still, ghost white in the moonlight, her hands cupped restfully on her concave belly, a mortician's perfect pose. Nancy! I scrambled over and, kneeling, lifted her head onto my lap. Her eyes opened slowly, then her mouth, although nothing came out at first. She gazed up at me dreamily, as if she were the beauty in the fairy tale awakening from her 100 years sleep. Then, with a look of extreme sadness and disappointment, she whispered, "You missed it, John." You missed the train. I held those words for several moments, echoing back and forth between the canyon walls, which became the sides of my head. I was furious. I think I started yelling at her. Or maybe I just got up and stomped off. I forget. She ran after me. "Hey, wait up. I'm sorry," she said, grabbing my arm. "I guess I get a little carried away sometimes." I spun around, fist clenched. I felt like punching her. I felt as if I were standing stark naked in front of her. A little carried away? A little? Okay, a lot carried away. A whole big bunch, stupid, idiotic, carried away. "I'm sorry, John, really." She was pleading with her hands. "Some joke. I hope you proved whatever the hell it was you were trying to prove, because what you did, just who do you think you are?" Then I realized I was shaking my finger at her like an adult. "That was really stupid." "I know," she said, looking penitently at her feet, "and I'm really, really, really sorry." I thought she was being sarcastic, but then I noticed she was about to cry. She was trying to hide it, but I could tell she wanted to. Then I felt rotten. "Look," I said, "it's getting late. Let's get the hell out of here." We walked back to the Corvette side by side, almost touching. She seemed her old, chatty, sassy self again, telling me about the story she was writing and how she was going to win the Nobel Prize for Literature someday. I said that was pretty ambitious. "Shoot for the stars," Robert Browning said, and she aimed a quick finger at the white buckshot powdering the night. Then it grew quiet again. The perpetual thunder had softened to the roar of a distant crowd. I remember the pine needles crackling underneath her giant shoes, the night size of the river, and the friction of her pleated skirt swishing across her skinny, sexless thighs. Well, that's John's introduction to Nancy von Kleinsmith. And after that, they end up spending every afternoon together. And I'll read you this section here. He says, "I met with Nancy regularly after that, every afternoon, Monday through Friday, in the student tutoring center. She quickly brushed aside the intermediate value theorem to tackle heftier issues, introducing topics with theatrical statements like, 'Did you know that in 1968 the government spent over $800 million testing, not developing, testing nuclear warheads?' She prodded until I took a stand. Quoting everyone from Milton to Ann Landers, Nancy would race me around her intellectual big top until I was the proverbial dog chasing its tail. She knew everything. I never knew how she felt about an issue because she always stood in direct opposition to me. If on Monday I was a hawk, she was a dove. If Tuesday I said give peace a chance, she clamored for war. If I was a Republican, she was a Democrat. When I spoke for ecology and environmental protection, she argued for more nuclear power plants and freedom from foreign oil. Because I was always Mormon, she had a field day with religion. I thought God loved everyone. How come your church won't let blacks hold the priesthood? Why can't women hold the priesthood? Brother Crum had prepared me for these questions, or so I thought. Well, we don't know why exactly. Don't know? Well, that's an interesting piece of doctrine. Clever, but not very original. Well, some people say it's because blacks were less valiant in the pre-existence. Less valiant? I rest my case. You're a racist church. I didn't say that. I said some Mormons think that. I mean, it's not doctrine. Then what is doctrine besides the don't know? And what about women? Were they bad too? Well, women don't need the priesthood. Women don't, but men do. Well, men and women have different roles. Well, that's for sure, master and slave. No, that's not what I meant. Women can have babies. Babies for women, priesthood for men? And what if a woman can't have children? Is she left in outer darkness? Well, women receive the priesthood through their husbands. And if a woman doesn't marry? I didn't know. I had never been seriously challenged about my religious beliefs, even though in my own way I had liked raising questions. I suppose I was known as something of a Mormon bad boy, which was okay because I was an insider stirring a complacent pot. But Nancy's attacks were direct. Instinctively, I found myself taking the defensive. "Racist and sexist," Nancy continued. "Your God doesn't consider blacks and women people." "Well, let me check about what we believe," I said, which meant that I would consult with Brother Crum or my father. "You do that, Reeves, and while you're at it, ask your friendly bishop what Joseph Smith meant when he said there's no such thing as immaterial matter. Isn't that fairly obvious? I mean, how profound." Earlier I had wondered what Nancy did for enjoyment. Now I knew. She took intense pleasure in attacking my faith. She worked overtime on it, researching what I was supposed to believe, plotting our next encounter. Her cheeks would flush, her eyes dilate, her mind and tongue engaged. Are you telling me you really believe that nonsense about Adam and Eve and the snake and the ark and golden plates and the heavens opening like something from the Land of Oz? And here comes the father and his boy saying, stop the music, kiddo. 100 zillion people can be wrong. Scrap the unholy mess and let's start all over again from scratch. Do you honestly think you and your wifey-to-be will live forever as God's populating worlds? Do you really swallow all that? What could I say? Should I square my shoulders and boldly proclaim, yes, without a shadow of a doubt? Or with the goggle-eyed self-righteousness of Tim Huber, the senior class dork, reply, yes, I know. The Holy Ghost has revealed this to me personally. My response was somewhat less affirmative. Well, yeah. Yeah? You're talking about the most significant commitment of your life, and all you can say is, yeah? Well, yeah, I mean, I really do believe. Why, John? Just tell me that. Why? I just do, that's all. It's a feeling I have. A feeling. Like indigestion? No, a good feeling. A warm. Comforting. Oh, comforting. I see. I could tell by her expression, that know-it-all smirk, that she was circling for the kill. I was desperate. If the Mormon Church isn't true, I argue weakly, why would my great-great-grandfather have traveled halfway around the world to settle in a desert like Salt Lake? Why would good, honest people like my bishop deliberately lie to me? Although fervid, my reply was subjective and hence unacceptable, Reeves, unacceptable. Nancy demanded logic, objectively verifiable evidence. None of this borrowed light business. If what you say is true, she countered, then how do you account for all the non-Mormons who died for their God? Does that make their faith true? Custer was a martyr, so was Hitler. Does that make them right? That's not the same thing. Oh, it's not? Well, please enlighten me. You're impossible. This whole discussion's impossible. Can't you get it through your thick head that the why isn't nearly as important as the what? It's what you do that matters. Nancy wasn't listening. She was busy purporting her next position. One more thing, Bishop Reeves. Believe it or not, parents lie. They lie to you about different things. They want to protect you, so they lie. Karl Marx was right when he called religion the great opiate. Religion eases the terror. Remember Hamlet? To be or not to be, that's the question. Nancy paused, waiting for my reply, but I had none. It was humiliating. The simple arguments that had flowed so convincingly from my father and Brother Crum tumbled ludicrously from my mouth. I felt like a fool. Well, at this, John is, because of his conversations with Nancy, he is compelled to start questioning his own beliefs. So all the things he has assumed to be true, that he has taken for face value, the things he's been conditioned to believe, he begins examining them and questioning them. And so he subsequently has some very, very bitter arguments with his mother. He's very intimidated by his father still, but they go at it a few times. John and Nancy, of course, wants to be a writer. And one day she decides, when John and Nancy are at the river, she decides to embark upon her most ambitious task possible. She decides she's going to turn John Reeves into a poet. So she takes him aside and says, all right, we're going to write haiku. And he says, no, I am not, there's no, enough is enough, I'm not going to write haiku. And she says, no, we're going to write haiku. And they're at the river, and he sees his buddies down here. And he says, well, look, if we have to do this, can we at least go downstream about a quarter of a mile? And she calls him a big sissy and says, okay, we're going to go down here. Well, what she does is she has him do this writing activity. And she discovers that he has a tremendous talent as a writer, a talent that she, in fact, doesn't have. And during their relationship, she inspires John to instead of wanting to become a pro football player, he decides he wants to become a writer. As their relationship progresses, they are never boy and girlfriend in the traditional sense. And so it really surprises John. John's shocked. He's caught off guard one day at the end of their senior year when Nancy says to him, invites him to the preference dance, the girl's choice. And John, caught off guard and kind of shocked, says, okay, let's go. So he picks Nancy up, and Nancy's very, very secretive about things. She lives at the end of a long graveled lane, and you can't see her house from the top of the highway, and she never lets John drive down that gravel lane. He says he can't. He has to let her off at the top. And even when they go out this night, she actually gets a formal, and they go out, and she meets him at the top of the lane. Well, what happens when they're on this date, I can't tell you because I'll give away all the good stuff in the book, But what happens is it leads to some very, very tragic consequences later on. And that night as they're driving home after this dance, they're talking. John's going to go away to BYU. He has a football scholarship. Nancy comes from a very poor family and will not be able to go to college. And so she's going to be left behind. And the last thing she says to him, she gives him this midnight admonition. She says, "Don't let them get you, John. Don't let them get you." And so John goes off. Nancy stays home. As I mentioned, there are certain tragic consequences that develop. John ends up, after some real soul searching, he ends up going on a mission, serving a mission in Mexico. He comes home. There are more tragedies that strikes him in his life. And he has a falling out with his father. And so he goes off literally on his own. He's a derelict. And the first part of the story ends there. And then it picks up here. Can you surprise God? Only if he's sleeping on the job. Then there's no difference between foreordination and predestination, is there? If God already knows everything we're going to do before we do it. Ah, but you've still forgotten freedom of choice. You could choose not to do what you're preordained to do. It's not a done deal. Oh, that's a Sunday school answer, you know. So typical. Well, can you one-up it? Easy. God's a know-it-all, right? Otherwise, he's not God. It's like he's the director and we're just players on the stage. The difference is he's seen the whole script and we haven't. He knows the ending and we don't. You mean we can't ad-lib? We may think we can, but a really, truly omniscient God would even know the ad-libs in advance. There are none, except from maybe our perspective. So time's irrelevant. For all practical purposes, Judgment Day occurred eons ago, before eons were even invented. Well, if that's true, why bother coming to Earth at all if God already knows the outcome? You tell me. Gloucester had an answer. We're as flies to wanton gods. They kill us for sport. Or maybe because we would have challenged the script. No, I wouldn't have robbed that liquor store on the night of July 16th. Maybe we have to play out the evidence for or against us. What's the point of playing if there's no hope? But there's always hope, and there's always freedom to choose. Is there? If we've existed since the beginning of time, which has no beginning, then our innate spirit or intelligence is right or wrong. Call it spiritual genetics. Which brings me back to my original question. Can you surprise God? Because if you can't, remember what remember when the brother of Jared sees the finger of the Lord? God acts surprised. Did you see more? Yeah, but that could be rhetorical too. Did you see more? Well, of course you did. I showed you more. So we're back to square one? Yes, but I've got another can of worms to open. You enjoy that, don't you, opening worm cans? Oh, immensely. A chip off the old block? You tell me. The proceeding was not an excerpt from one of my high school conversations with Nancy von Kleinschmidt. It was a postprandial dialogue with my 16-year-old daughter, Valerie, the kid genius. Val is flunking half her classes because she refuses to submit to boring worksheets that are nothing but mule work and an insult to her intelligence, quote unquote. Why, for instance, won't her physics teacher simply let her design a nuclear-powered dishwasher or a frictionless V6 engine and be done with it? My wife, Natalie, retorts, "Why can't you just for once in your stubborn little obstinate life play the stupid game? You're slitting your own throat. Can't you see that?" "You said it," she says, "because it's stupid and a game." Natalie hollers at her through the bedroom door. "If you don't turn in all those missing assignments, if you don't, I'm going to..." "Going to what?" Val snickers. "What precisely? Ground her? She doesn't drive, doesn't date, doesn't dance, doesn't much of anything except hole up in a room playing her cello and writing scripts for TV sitcoms that are doomed to someday make her rich and famous. And poems. Tragic, depressing, awful, horrible, nihilistic things," quote unquote, Natalie. "Val, come down for dinner," she hollers through the wood. "Leave it outside the door," Val hollers back. Self-incarceration is a sign of true genius or insanity, the line between the two being very fine indeed. She tells us she hates church, hates the Book of Mormon, hates Sister Myers, her advisor. "All she ever says," Val sneers, "is get married and have babies. Make dumb babies." Val says she hates babies, would never, ever in a million years get married. Not like that, not like her. "So why are you forcing her to go to church? Doesn't she have free agency? Isn't compulsion Satan's plan? She can't wait until she graduates from high school and is on her own. Boy, oh boy, I'll never go to church. Ever. Just you wait." "If you graduate," Natalie corrects. Natalie can't understand her attitude. Natalie loves Sunday school, the scriptures, youth conferences. With Val, it's always pulling teeth. What's the matter with her? Why can't she just be a normal kid? Why can't she be like Renee Pickett and Geraldine Crowley, obliviously nodding along just because Mommy and Daddy say so? Natalie makes a sour face. No, not like them. It's just that, well, when is she going to grow up? Just because we believe doesn't mean she will. She wants facts, verifiable data. None of this borrowed light business for her. Believe me, I know her type. Oh, and how do you know her type? Take my word for it, I know. I don't see how you can just sit there calmly and smugly watching your life go down the tubes. Who's smug? Who's sitting calmly? This is our daughter we're talking about, not some scientific experiment we can redo if it fails. What can we do? We've done everything. She can figure it out. It's up to her now. Am I too indifferent? Am I trying to cover misplaced tracks? Should I give her more time, set a better example, pound the pulpit a little harder, painting life more like a precise checkerboard of blacks and whites instead of pandering to the great god of ambivalence? Val is brilliant yet innocent in a matter wholly different from her younger sister, Rachel, whom she used to pick on mercilessly, but now simply ignores. The null set, Val used to call her, and Rachel would look up naively, smiling her lollipop smile. What? Rachel is the only one who will wake up to discover I have left for the day and weep real tears. Where's Dad? He took a little trip. How come? He needed some time alone. You mean like a time out? Natalie's cure for back talk and temper tantrums was 10 minutes of solitary in the downstairs bathroom. No books, no toys, no newspapers. Just you, the wash basin, and the toilet bowl. Yes, like a timeout. Rachel's saucer eyes grow big and fearful. Is he coming back? Yes, of course he's coming back. Is he coming back soon? Yes, soon. Tonight sometime. Where did he go? Natalie will ponder this briefly before answering. Home. Home? Rachel's bulbous brow will wrinkle with bewilderment. Isn't home here? She will continue her mawkish questioning until Natalie, wiping the kitchen counter, stirring the pancake batter, laying out the breakfast plates, feels mentally and emotionally drained. She will close her eyes, count to 10, mutter to herself the incantation she learned in Relief Society a week ago. Stop. Relax. Drop your shoulders and roll your head. God will not overprogram you. God will not overprogram you. All day, Rachel stays close to the big bay window, keeping an eye out for me. She dutifully feeds her baby dolls from a plastic bottle she painstakingly fills with thousands of tiny circles she has hole-punched from white construction paper. Milk, Dad, see? She changes their disposable diapers a dozen times, reads to them from her golden book of children's verses, and takes each for a short walk in her Fisher-Price stroller. She's 11 going on 5, growing little cone-shaped breasts before she ought to. Her classmates listen to Paula Abdul and Michael Jackson, R.E.M. They go steady with goofy-looking boys and brag about going to first, second, and third base. You play baseball? Rachel asks. She has one more summer to grow up before starting junior high, where the kids hang out in gangs and snort cocaine for breakfast. Val used to tease Rachel about her babies. What are you going to be when you grow up? A mommy. I can't do anything else, so I'll be a mommy. Talk like that always gets a rise out of Natalie. Usually she handles it with humor. Hey, you in there, she will holler, slouching into the living room caveman style, shoulders rounded, hands dragging along the sculptured carpeting, lowering her voice, the dumb football player. Hey, who's saying stuff about being a mom? What's wrong with being a mom, huh? She has a bachelor's degree in chemistry and dropped her master's ambitions to marry me and bring 3 children into the world. Does she regret it? Don't be silly, she says in her sunnier moods. Other times she gestures to the glossy plaque above her chest of drawers, a double-edged birthday gift from her mother, Mrs. Johnson, with a T. I could have been a brain surgeon. Natalie won't miss me today. I've been so snarly that my absence will be a reprieve. Even J.J., John Jr., my grinning little miniature, has noticed. Dad, how come you always act like Grouchy Bug? The Grouchy Ladybug. I bought him that picture book about that irascible insect to cure his temper tantrums. Look, just because I'm on the bishopric doesn't mean I don't have my ups and downs and in-betweens. People think you walk on water. They think you can't swear once in a while or snitch a sandwich on Fast Sunday or yell some poor fool's head off. And then there's a little break. One night, when you were a little baby, I had this funny feeling something was wrong. I couldn't go to sleep. I finally got up and went into your room. The blanket was over your head and your face was all blue. If the Spirit hadn't warned me, Mom, how do you know that was the Holy Ghost? How do you know it wasn't the psychic prompting? The Holy Ghost is a psychic prompting. Natalie can't understand why no one asked Val to the homecoming dance. She's tall, slender, long legs like a model, classic California, like her mom. Well, I didn't know I was that good. Is that a cue? How much time do we have? We're okay. Okay. Oh, Natalie can't understand why no one asked Val to the homecoming dance. Well, would you want to go out with an ice pick? A what? It's a foolhardy thing to say, and I invent an instant edit. With a nice kid. Sister Myers tells Val and the other young women that they are special chosen spirits sent to Earth at a special chosen time for a special chosen purpose. They are the most valiant of Heavenly Father's spirit children reserved for these latter days. Val rolls her eyes and groans. Her arrogance is almost as intimidating as her IQ. The glory of God is intelligence, she says. Just don't ever use it. A week ago, I committed an unpardonable and sneaked into a room. Just curious, prowling for nothing in particular, just clues to get inside that busy little brain of hers. I did not see the leather-bound scriptures we bought her for her 12th birthday. No frame poster featuring young women's values, no New Era Mormon ads, no certificates of church achievement. Instead, Linda Goodman's sun signs and Chero's Language of the Hand, books on astrology and handwriting analysis. I saw knickknacks on the wall, a poster of Magic Johnson slam dunking a full moon below a fluorescent red caption, The Magic Kingdom. Box games, a picture of a tiger stalking through the snow. The masks of comedy and tragedy, the former turned upside down, making a dour duo. And one more, a black light poster featuring a young woman, slender and blonde in a flowing white gown, sitting at the foot of a glittering waterfall in some fantasy land. She is gazing longingly at the horizon where a little family of white unicorns is sipping from a bubbling stream. She holds a bouquet of pink flowers. No caption, no title. Then I noticed a corner of her spiral-bound journal protruding from underneath her bed. I opened and read, "Love is an ice pick. It is a poem, which is a process, which is the kid genius, the would-be God prophet you must be willing to follow blindfolded through the rough and dark and slippery parts. You must sometimes follow the snake into its hole. Are you with me? Are you? Or against? Then get out of your sweet skin and think for a change. Go blow your beautiful brains to kingdom come, all ye weary and benighted, etc. is unto me." I heard footsteps, shut it fast, and slipped out just in time. But suspicious eyes passed me coming up the stairs. Later that night, Val confronted me. "Why did you quit writing?" Natalie looked up from her People magazine. "He didn't quit. He never quit." I smiled. "I'm a no-talent bum, a has-been who never was." Val quietly folded up her music. It suddenly occurred to me that, A, for some peculiar reason she had deigned to practice her cello downstairs in the living room amidst us, and, B, she had interrupted her intense practice just to ask me, out of the apparent blue, this question. "I'm going to be a scriptwriter," she announced resolutely. "I'm going to write screenplays. I'm going to be famous." I could have told her all about backups and safety nets. Instead, I smiled, winked, whispered, "Go for it, kid." She almost smiled back. Later, Natalie reminded me she was failing three classes. No hope for a college scholarship. She was burning all her bridges. Mentally, I reviewed the worst-case scenarios. She lives at home and goes to a junior college, or gets a job waiting tables in a bar, or gets pregnant and jumps off a 25-foot bridge, or a rock. There's always a more worst-case scenario. I'm up late again in the living room, 2:30 a.m. For the third straight night, I have been prowling the 2,000-square-foot confines of our home in search of sleep. Eventually, I will succumb from sheer exhaustion. Experience has taught me that. Sometimes it takes two or three nights, other times a week or more. In the meantime, I drag around like a waterlogged zombie, dozing off at work, in the car, during Bishop Finley's diatribes. But the worry cycle starts. gotta get some Z's because this other, it does funny things to you. It scrambles your brain and your body until it's not really you saying whatever it was you said, throwing whatever it was you threw. I try to blame the obvious, but I'd been wrestling with Morpheus long before the incident, months before Bishop Finley's midnight call. Do you know a Robert Johnson? Robbie? Sure, he's in my fifth hour class. Can you come over right away? What's up? Is there some kind of problem? Well, yes. Yes, there's a problem. Tonight I honestly thought I would win for a change. I'd done everything the doctor ordered. Warm bath, yoga stretches, deep breathing exercises, mental imaging, prayer, calcium, and horse pill proportions. But I'm up again, drifting from room to room, covetous of my children's perfect sleep, and a little resentful of Natalie's. I feel so absolutely alone in the house, disconnected, as if Natalie and the children have moved on to a different realm without me, like a lone man in the Garden of Eden. I look across the valley where the streetlights are glowing in the fog like an underwater city, a dream world I have become trapped in. I want to sneak back upstairs and hug my children, make sure they are still there. Instead, I crawl back into bed where Natalie has long since entered the land I've been banned from. Is this, in microcosm, the agony of spirit prison, being the one left behind? I place my hand on her soft thigh, press my front to her backside, and try to join her, but I'm denied. The brain resumes its high-speed chase to nowhere. Can God change his mind? Of course he can. He's God. He can do anything. If he knows everything, why would he ever want to change his mind? I used to teach up until a year ago. Now I write grants for the Santa Vista Public Schools. It was part of the so-called deal the attorney for the teachers' union cut with the administration. In their view, I got off easy. My view, I work long and late, and I hate it. Well, at least now you get to use your writing talents, Natalie offers. She means well, but she knows better. Grant writing isn't writing, I holler during a volcanic moment. It's nothing but a lot of logical left-brain bullshit. To which Natalie reminds me curtly, it's also a paycheck. My students were the ones who called it dumbbell English. The first day of class, I used to hand out 3x5 cards and tell them to write their name and one interesting or unusual thing about themselves. I'm Tom and I'm stupid. It was depressing how many cards I'd get like that. When I'd ask about the response, they would shrug. Everybody says so. Who's everybody? My old man, his girlfriend, my friends, everybody. Later, I told them to write their name and one good thing about themselves. They would scratch their heads, make jokes, snort, grunt, guffaw, but eventually, with some self-probing, they would mine very deep and come up with a sparkling bit of something. I'm Tom, and I fix transmissions. I missed those kids, although in the beginning I never thought I would. In the beginning, it seemed like a jail sentence. 5 years remedial English. But after earning tenure, I refused to move up. My department chair thought I was nuts. American Lit, Creative Writing, Advanced Comp, AP English, take your pick. You've served your time. Now I know the real thing. Monday through Friday, I descend into the basement of the school district administration building and lock myself in a concrete office that my higher-ups refer to as the dungeon. It is dark when I leave for work in the morning and darker still when I return home at night. Let's see how much is left. Okay. 3:07. Fed up, desperate, I throw on my paint-stained sweatpants and T-shirt and go running through the neighborhood, searching for lighted windows, the silhouettes of fellow insomniacs. But every home seems at rest, a ship peacefully harbored for the night. Nearing the cul-de-sac, I see another demon from my dreams, ghost-like in the early morning mist, a two-legged centaur in shiny blue gym trunks galloping away from me. I break into a wild sprint, sucking in the salty Pacific air, my floppy Kmart sneakers clapping across the pavement, my eyes boring into his big blue behind. It is a futile chase, yet I run beyond exhaustion to oblivion. I run until my lungs cave in and my legs buckle and snap. I'm a broken pretzel on the blacktop, knees and elbows stinging. I look up at a rainbow ring streetlight. I blink once and it's a big white egg in an iridescent nest, twice and it's the moon. I close my eyes, press my palms flat against the cool pavement, and beg God to please grant me sleep. Kneeling on the living room floor, I sense another presence in the room. I say a hasty amen and turn to find my genius daughter watching in her nightgown. She is wearing the most peculiar expression, like the time 12 years ago when she caught Natalie and me sneaking carefully wrapped gifts under the lighted Christmas tree. It was not a look of shock or betrayal, but the omniscient smirk of Nancy von Kleinschmidt. Dad? I smile, rise to my feet awkwardly, as if I am trying to stand up in a rowboat, a little self-consciously and self-conscious of my self-consciousness. She tilts her head at an odd angle. Dad, I have a question. Shoot, I say, dusting off my knees as if I had been kneeling in the dirt rather than on soft white carpeting. She gestures to the Book of Mormon lying open face down on the floor, an arm's length from my feet. Dad, can an intelligent, educated person like you really believe in all that mumbo-jumbo? It worries me that I have to summon up all my earthly courage to look her squarely in the eye and answer, yes. For a good half minute, she stares at me as if I am an odd piece of furniture she's not sure what to do with. Smiling, she disappears. John? When I finally look up, I see Natalie peering around the corner. The clock reads 5:27 a.m. Are you still going? It takes a moment. Going? Well? I glance at the yellow pad on my lap. The top page is covered with incomprehensible scribble a seer couldn't decipher. Yes, I say, rising from the sofa. Sure, I'm going. Trailing her through the kitchen to the back door, I notice that on the families can be together forever sign taped the refrigerator, someone has penciled in a subscript. Do they have to be? I shake my head. Val. Have you got something? Have you got everything? Sack lunch, swim trunks, rolled up inside a beach. Have you got everything? Sack lunch, swim trunks, rolled up inside a beach towel like a terry cloth cigar. Don't you want to change out of your sweats? Why, I'm not going to the junior prom. She shrugs. Suit yourself. A month ago, we were butting heads over this trip. Now she almost seems to be shoving me out the door. With a deft two-finger movement, I hit the light switch and the remote below it, and the garage door shutters briefly as it rolls open like a big, slow eyelid. It is still dark out, and the shadows and silhouettes of the suburban plants look grimly Congo-esque. The lights in the valley are twinkling like a fallen Milky Way. I am awed by the simple beauty of the scene and diminished by the infinity of it. Natalie gives me a peck on the cheek like a mother sending her little boy off to his first day of school. She reminds me that JJ has to give a talk in primary. Ah! I hit my palm against my forehead, a token gesture. I haven't forgotten, really. I've simply run out of time again. Look, tell him I'll help him when I get home. And don't you go and do it, I said. I said I would and I will. She smiles knowingly. Then should we expect you for dinner? Well, maybe. A hand goes to her hip. Well, that helps. Okay, no. As I tuck my 6'3 frame inside her old Toyota Corolla, she leans casually against the doorway, long and lovely in her magenta house robe, domestic cheesecake. A loose strand of chestnut hair droops seductively over one eye. She waves her fingers as if sprinkling fairy dust and says, without malice or sarcasm, have a nice day. Waving back, I'm overcome by a sudden sadness as if I were leaving on a journey of indefinite dimensions to the moon and back. She smiles and says something I can't hear over the high-pitched squeal of the V-belts, which sounds like a mass orgy of rats. I remind myself it's time for a tune-up. And a new transmission. And new tires. And. I glance at the odometer. 159.876. New car. I push in the clutch and carefully pull the stick back into reverse, wincing in anticipation of the inevitable grinding of the gearbox, mentally crossing my fingers that it won't, knowing full well that it will. I mutter sweet good-for-nothings to the cracked vinyl dash as the stick slips into gear without protest, only to be betrayed by a belated garbage disposal grind and growl. Damn! Natalie is still talking, saying things I cannot hear. I roll down the window, poke my head out, jab a finger at my ear. When you get back, she says, I have a little surprise for you. What? A surprise. I switch off the ignition and start to get out, a bit irritated, but she stops me with a little head shake that whisks a loose strand of hair flirtatiously across her face. When you get back, she mouths and disappears inside. Well, with that send-off, John Reeves is going back to his hometown. He's 42 years old. And you get kind of a sense of of his present state of mind and soul from that chapter. He's going back to his hometown. He has not been there in 23 years since he left for his mission. And he's going back for one purpose only. He's not going back to drag skeletons out of the closets or to look up old friends. In fact, he wants to avoid. He wants to go totally incognito. He doesn't want to see anybody. He wants to go to the river. And he wants for one whole day, he just wants to lollygag in the sun and not think about anything. And that's his purpose. He goes back, And, of course, it doesn't work out that way. He ends up dragging numerous skeletons out of his closet, resurrecting ghosts, past, present, and future. And he has to confront those tragedies that were a result of some of the decisions he made in his youth. He comes face to face with those again. And should we take a break?
Sure.
Should we take a break? Let's take a break. Okay. Thank you. Either's fine. Questions would be fine. Okay. That works for me.
Okay.
Oh, thanks. Are those good chapters?
Yes. Yeah.